Clare Grove.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now then, as titles go, this one should get you listening. It's called Did You Really Shoot the Television? And yes, it does feature the death of a TV set, as we're about to hear. Full story, though, later in the week. It's written by Max Hastings, author, journalist, broadcaster and former editor of both the Daily Telegraph and the London Evening Standard. And it's all about the Hastings family, and in particular his parents, the broadcaster and adventurer MacDonald Hastings and the glamorous gardening writer and one-time editor of Harper's Bazaar, Anne Scott James. So let's begin at the beginning, and in part one, Max Hastings recalls his entrance into the world as the elephant.
I am the least significant character in the story that follows. But it was an inquiry about the fate of the TV set in the London family flat of my childhood which prompted me to embark upon it. Throughout the long life of my mother, the journalist and gardening writer Anne Scott James, I wrote little about our tumultuous family experiences. In 1986, featured as the castaway on the BBC's Desert Island Discs, I dodged tricky questions about parental relations. I inclined to my mother's view that
all families are dysfunctional.
However, when she enjoyed the same experience on DID in 2003, at the age of 90, she was much less inhibited. To the audience's delight and my toe-curling embarrassment, she regaled Sue Lawley with tales of our old squabbles and of my pretty frightful childhood behaviour. For weeks afterwards, people came up to me in filling stations and other unlikely places demanding, "Here, did you really shoot the television?" We shall address that question in due course, but I want to make plain immediately that it was not a big set. It's easy to see why my father married Anne. She was beautiful, clever, witty, and professed an enthusiasm for the rural life so dear to his heart. It's harder to perceive what Anne saw in Mac. A droll observer might note that he, like her first husband, was the enthusiastic and somewhat reckless owner of a .22 rifle. But that can scarcely have been her sole criterion for picking mates. She asserted in old age that she gained an insight into Mac's priorities when, soon after they were married, she heard him remark at a party,
"I've got the three things I wanted most. A Churchill gun, a Hardy rod, and a beautiful wife."
While Anne was in hospital after my birth in 1945, late one night at their flat in Chelsea, Mac seized a few sheets of paper, wrote a letter to his newborn son, sealed it in an envelope, filed it away, and presented it to me on my 21st birthday. Its tone reflected all father's enthusiasm, delusions of family grandeur, and serene assurance that life, in this case my life, would conform to his own romantic vision.
"My dear boy, I am writing this alone in our flat, while you yourself are lying in your cot in the baby's nursery, with rows of other people's babies all around you, blowing bubbles and working your arms as if your face was covered with cobwebs. The nurses have christened you the elephant, because when you were born, you weighed 8 pounds, 8 ounces. Because of your background, and because it seems possible that you may inherit the literary bent of your forebears, at this moment we're giving serious consideration to your name, which, in the literary world, means your fortune. Your grandfather, on my side, was christened Basil, to his lifelong disgust. But it served him right, because he christened me Douglas. It didn't matter much, because all the world has called us Mac. Your mother's tired of Mac, so our idea at the moment is to compromise and christen you Max. Full name, Max Hugh MacDonald Hastings. Hugh was the name of your great-grandfather on my side, who was a don in classics at London University and fought in the American Civil War. MacDonald was the family name of your paternal great-grandmother, who was one of the authentic MacDonalds of Glencoe, and who died of bad temper. But you'll hear most of these things in the normal course of growing up. What I want to put down for you now is what your mother and I almost certainly will have got out of focus by the time this letter comes into your hands. How we're feeling, what we're thinking now, at the beginning of your life. Because you've come into the world at one of the strangest and most dangerous hours in human history. Believe me, it's needed some courage to bring you into it at all. But we've argued, your mother and I, that as we're not afraid of the future, you won't be afraid either. So, here you are.
Of course that letter has given me huge pleasure. But I've often wondered whether Father would have displayed the sensitivity to withhold it from me if I disappointed his passionate hope that as the son of two writers, I would become a writer myself. My mother wrote,
Max was an impetuous character. Even at the fetus stage, always in a rush, he arrived 2 weeks early.
Weekdays were spent in London, where I became a child of Hyde Park and Kensington Gardens. On Friday evenings, we crowded into the family Austin for a car-sick two-hour ride to West Berkshire, past the diving neon-lit lady atop the Janssen swimwear factory in Hounslow. When my mother first acquired Rose Cottage in 1938, it was an unimproved farm worker's dwelling with earthen floor and outdoor sanitation. Over the years that followed, it was rebuilt, extended, and furnished with her usual excellent taste. It had three small bedrooms above, one of them mother's, and one downstairs for father. This arrangement seemed at the time perfectly normal, but prompts a sigh from me now. I loved the cottage and the countryside, and the almost unlimited scope for troublemaking they offered, while finding London life pretty dreary in those immediate post-war years. I achieved an early disgrace one Friday evening when we were disembarking from the family Austin on the steepish decline where we offloaded. As our nanny emerged, on a whim, I released the handbrake. This set the car rolling briskly downhill and caused Nanny to break her leg. Amazingly, she displayed not the slightest ill will about her subsequent fortnight in hospital. Like almost every child of my time and class, I adored Nanny. When Matt committed some social crime, she would drop a prim remark which emphasized how far down in the world she found herself amid the Hastings household. Sir Edward, her former employer in Kenya, was buried at sea off the Ajax. The unspoken corollary was that Father's remains, far from attaining the glories of submersion from a cruiser of the Royal Navy, would be fortunate to secure disposal from a tramp steamer. Some of my rural pleasures were entirely innocent. Picking bluebells, picnics with Nanny. Other diversions led to trouble. I blush to remember how poorly I repaid my younger sister's sweetness and loyalty. You won't tell Mummy and Daddy, will you? Claire saw me drop Father's lovely Walther 2.2 rifle from a treetop house, smashing the stock, then glue the pieces together again to delay discovery of my crime. When I was 9, Father penned a magazine piece entitled Conversation with My Son, from which, Can I have some nails for my hammer, Daddy? It isn't your hammer, it's mine. And what do you intend doing with the nails? I'm making a soapbox car. Where? Up at the tool shed. It's quite all right, Daddy. I'm not doing any damage to your things. Really, I'm not. What's that stuff on your hands? Just paint. That's self-evident. I want to know what you've been painting. The kiddie car. Claire's kiddie car? I asked her if she'd like it in another colour, and she said she would. So you did it to oblige your little sister. Where is she now? Up at the tool shed. What's she doing? Riding the kiddie car. The one you've just painted? I told her it was wet paint, but she wouldn't wait, Daddy. Just you wait until your mother hears about this. Where are you going, Daddy? Where do you think I'm going? If you're going to the tool shed, do you want to go inside, Daddy? Certainly. Why not? Well, it might be a bit difficult at the moment. You see, Claire was very naughty, and I thought she was going to take her kiddie car on the road. Well? Well, Daddy, I used some of those old bricks up the garden to make a barricade. Let's get this clear. You have bricked up your sister in the tool shed where she is riding the kiddie car you have just painted. I told her not to, Daddy. As a matter of interest, since you bricked up the door, how have you yourself been getting in and out of the tool shed? Through the window. But that window won't open. It's open now, Daddy. Do you mean you've broken it? I was coming to that, Daddy. I suggest that this passage shows how ponderous and pompous Father could be. Others say that it displays his acute ear as a reporter. Mother wrote on the subject of school holidays.
It's pleasant to recall how one sweet, romping day succeeded another. Take the pleasure-laden week, the week when my son took my daughter, well wrapped up, on a few minutes' stroll in the sun, and brought her home, stumbling blindly 2 hours later, gloves, cap, and muffler gone. We went a little too far, he explained.
Mother would stay through the first couple of days, then race back to the office in a haze of scent and high purpose. My parents' habit, endemic among journalists, of exploiting family life as column fodder, was a source of much embarrassment to me at school. Years later, my own children reproached me for alleged parental shortcomings. I pointed out that, unlike my parents, I was never absent from the bucket and spade round. Maybe, said my daughter, but you never looked as if you enjoyed it much. My father seemed to me to be possessed of superhuman powers to make exciting things happen. It was in his gift to provide stars' autographs, fix meetings with comedians, privilege backstage visits to the circus. I was equally awed by my mother, but in a different way. For a start, she was dauntingly tall, near enough 6 feet, and never less than flawlessly turned out. In my irritation at her absences, I lacked any perception of the difficulties every woman then faced if she attempted to combine marriage and motherhood with a career. As she left in the morning, I pleaded, "Mummy, try and get back for tea. But I know you'll be late." Her outbursts of anger were alarming, often provoked by displays of incompetence, especially those perpetrated by Mac, of which allowing the car to run out of petrol was the most commonplace. I trembled before her wrath. I can still conjure vividly the image of a night when she burst into my room in a rage and transparent negligee to catch me reading by torchlight under the bedclothes. Until the day of her death, she perceived herself as the gentle, much put upon little creature of the forest. I, by contrast, saw her as possessing many of the characteristics of a Sherman tank.
And tomorrow, in part two, Mac is made a star contributor of Eagle magazine and his gifts for delusion soar. Did You Really Shoot the Television? Was written and read by Max Hastings, with additional readings by Nigel Hastings as Mac and Joanne Munro as Anne. It was abridged by Penny Lester, and the producer was Duncan Minchell.